This week on The Score, was the gay rights movement propelled by capitalism? Why do people want to break up Facebook? Has the University of Virginia changed the way students graduate? How will Trump administration tariffs and trade policy affect the U.S. economy? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Last week on the show, we talked to historian David Johnson about his book, The Lavender Scare, which has been turned into a documentary film opening in theaters next month. This week, we continue our conversation and learn about Dr. Johnson's most recent book called Buying Gay, which explores how 20th century entrepreneurs took advantage of the free enterprise system, leading to political achievements in the 21st century. That gives us a good transition to your more recent book, Buying Gay, which is about how our free market economy essentially was the impetus for making the gay rights movement and the acquisition of the same rights as everybody else for gay people through commercial activities. Can you give me a description of your new book, Buying Gay?
Sure. One of my friends likes to say the thesis of it is that gays were capitalists too. It makes the case that, so it looks at the same period as the Lavender Scare. It looks at the 50s and 60s and that kind of beginnings of the gay movement, but through the lens of consumer culture, and follows a series of gay entrepreneurs who started businesses, things like Physique magazine publishing companies, gay book clubs, clothing catalogs. They were all targeting a gay market, right, as early as the 1950s. And so the argument is that long before we could imagine ourselves as a forceful political movement, we saw that we were an economic force and a market. Gay men all over the country were buying and reading Physique magazines and realizing that there were thousands of others of them out there all over the country, and not just in New York and San Francisco, but all over. You could get these magazines on newsstands anywhere, or you could get them through the mail.
And getting them through the mail is a major point, because the publishers or the entrepreneurs were putting together mailing lists and finding actual, using what we might now call direct mail marketing,
right,
in order,
right,
to reach their customers. And those mailing lists became the basis for community organizing and legal organizing, because some of these publications were challenged by the Postal Department, and that led to some legal victories in the federal courts.
Right. So these entrepreneurs, they established some of the first gay mailing lists, right, which were important economically, obviously, for their businesses. But it's mailing lists that, are the basis of a political movement as well. And the small political organizations at the time, the gay organizations like the Mattachine Society and One Incorporated, they also had gay mailing lists, but they were tiny. They were about a tenth the size of their entrepreneurial counterparts. So they were sort of jealous of them. Some of these entrepreneurs helped get these homophile movements going. They would, they would share mailing lists. And then they became the target, like you said, of postal censorship. They were considered, their magazines, because they had, the bodybuilding magazines, they weren't nudes, but they were, sort of salacious images of men in what they called posing straps. Post office considered them obscene. Not that they revealed any more flesh than, say, you could see in Playboy of a woman, but they knew that these images of men were being viewed and purchased by other men. So they considered them to be promoting homosexuality in American society, and that's why they tried to shut them down. And they had quite a vigorous campaign to do that. They would infiltrate mailing lists with false names. They would raid production facilities. Almost all of the entrepreneurs that I wrote about certainly spent time in court, and a couple of them spent time in prison for what they were publishing.
And then I guess it was the One Ink Supreme Court decision from 1957 that was sort of a breakthrough. It was the first time that the Supreme Court ruled in favor of a gay plaintiff, or I don't know whether it's a defendant, but it was a major victory for free speech from sort of a general point of view, but also for the gay movement in particular.
You're right, it was, but I argue that the more important decision was a few years later. It was Manuel V. Day in 1962. The one decision was made without oral arguments. There was no written decision. So it wasn't exactly clear what the basis of the decision was. In Manuel V. Day, it's Lynn Womack, who was one of these Physique magazine publishers. He's taken to court on obscenity charges, and he fights it all the way to the Supreme Court. And he was able to do that, unlike a lot of the other folks I write about, because he had kind of consolidated almost an empire. He had a bunch of magazines, and he had his own distribution company. So he had the wherewithal to fight this. And those were actually, it was Manuel V. Day that we had the first oral arguments in the Supreme Court on a gay issue.
Well, that must have been significant. It must be fascinating to read those transcripts today.
Yeah, you can actually listen to the oral arguments. They're all recorded.
And I suppose that it was difficult for some of those gay and lesbian plaintiffs back in those days to find lawyers who were willing to argue on their behalf, so that the attorneys themselves were rather brave members of the profession to do what they did.
Yes, they definitely were. The plaintiff, the attorney for Manuel V. Day had gone to GW, George Washington University, as an undergraduate. He was interested in business, I said, but he kept being told by his professors, I can't answer that question. You'll have to talk to your attorneys. So he decided to get a law degree. And then he kind of discovered, actually it was racial discrimination in Washington, D.C., and he wanted to stay and fight that. And then he also became an attorney for a lot of gay men, arrested in Lafayette Park, and became a defender of those gay men, and that's how Lynn Womack found him, and how he became the first attorney to argue a gay case before the Supreme Court.
Well, that's an amazing story in itself. I imagine that would be part of a good law journal article. Well, just to sum up, what was the outcome of these various business enterprises, and how did they lead to the eventually a successful gay rights movement that we have today?
It's not a simple, direct narrative, but I think they've first of all, created this kind of virtual or imagined national network, like through their products and the consumer culture network that they created. They also created a kind of a rhetoric in their magazines that said, we as consumers of these physique magazines are being oppressed. Like the government is trying to censor us and prevent us from having this print gathering space, and we need to stand up and defend our rights, a right to buy these products. So it creates this kind of sense of a national community, and it's actually more than a sense, right? They win the legal right to publish these materials. And pretty soon the physique world kind of merges with the small political homophile organizations. Their publications after Manuel Vidae become a lot more like physique magazines. So there's a kind of merging of the physique world and the homophile world.
Well, I think if there's any takeaway from your story, it's one that free speech is very important for the progression of minority rights, however you define them, that people who are oppressed need to be able to exercise their rights to free speech and freedom of the press, and that we should be very careful of protecting those rights, and also that the free enterprise system contributes to the political rights that we now are able to exercise. And that's a story that I think is underreported.
Absolutely. And in the 50s, there was this notion that gay people were somehow conspiring with communists, or they actually were communists, and, you know, they were undermining American democracy. But what it turns out is that it was actually, a lot of gay people were, in fact, capitalists, and it was the capitalist system that helped foster this movement.
Well, it's an amazing story. I'm looking forward to reading the book. I keep putting off buying a copy, but I definitely will do so over the weekend. David Johnson, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate your comments, and I wish you good luck both with the film of The Lavender Scare and the new book, Buying Gay.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Many people are angry at Facebook and other social media sites. Some are urging the government to pursue antitrust actions. Even Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes, who was Mark Zuckerberg's Harvard roommate, has called for the breakup of the company he started. I asked Cato Institute Vice President John Samples about the possibility of the government breaking up Facebook. We spoke last Monday in Washington. There was an article in the New York Times last Sunday by one of the co-founders of Facebook, Chris mm-hmm. Hughes, mm-hmm. arguing that the company he co-founded should be broken up. Mm-hmm. My response to that was, if Chris Hughes wants to reduce the dominance of Facebook, he should run the place like he ran the New Republic.
Well, of course, that's been a few years now, Rick, and what you're saying here is that he took a venerable, previously successful magazine and essentially ran it into the ground.
Exactly. And that's apparently what he would like to do with Facebook. But just to get serious for a moment, he's not the only person who's calling for antitrust laws to be brought to bear against Facebook and perhaps other social media as a way to control it.
Absolutely.
But it seems to me that breaking up Facebook is not as simple as they think. You could spin off WhatsApp and Instagram, and the three entities could be successful. Mm-hmm. But the rest of Facebook seems to be very integrated. What are the component parts you can break it into?
Well, let's draw back for a minute, Rick, and think, you know, antitrust policy is for a reason. It exists to assure competition. It's based on the idea that sometimes you get monopolies that you can't compete your way out of. They're natural monopolies or something like that. Now, over the last 40 to 50 years, and because of conservatives, this is one of the great achievements of conservative public policy theorists, we have had a standard for using antitrust that focused on consumer welfare. We didn't ask how big they are, how concentrated they are, the old questions of antitrust when liberals are in power, but rather, what is the effect on the consumer here? If the prices don't go up, if consumers are getting more for less, what is the point of going through all of this vast process to break up or to regulate an industry? So that was the question, and that's been the standard. Now, with these companies, I think you have to say that it's very hard to argue that consumers are being harmed. Now, it's wrong to say that they're not paying anything or there is an exchange. People get on the networks, they agree to certain terms, and they get the services. They get access to their friends and to social networks. On the other hand, there's data about the preferences that then the companies take and use it to better make advertising, really, along with advertisers. So that's a very valuable thing. So there is that exchange, but that price hasn't gone up, and these companies are innovating all the time and getting larger also, and doing, both Google and Facebook in particular, doing different kinds of things. So this, you're getting more value, as it were, the price remains the same to the extent that there's a price at all. It's a very hard case to make on the consumer welfare standard that there's something to be done here. Now, what people like Chris Hughes and others say is, well, what concerns me, and Hughes said this, is that this man, Mark Zuckerberg, has become so powerful that this is, you know, Facebook is 2.5 billion people now, and Zuckerberg is the predominant shareholder. So it's not really the traditional conservative way of going about antitrust. It's that, oh, this man is too powerful and we need to break him up to make it more accountable. Sometimes people say we need to make 6 or 7 of them so that the content moderation, people will always have some kind of place to go if their speech doesn't meet the standards of one. If you get thrown off Facebook now, you don't have a place to go, and so on. But all of these things don't have anything to do with what has been a really successful antitrust standard of consumer welfare. It has more to do with politics, I think, and a political concern.
Yeah, and it seems to have very little to do with competition. Google, which by any definition is bigger than Facebook, mm-hmm. had a competitor to Facebook called mm-hmm. Google Plus mm-hmm. that failed miserably. Mm-hmm. And there are other smaller competitors that people participate in, Snapchat, right. Reddit, Dig. A friend of mine invited me to join MeWe, which mm-hmm. is an upstart competitor to Facebook. I quit after about 6 months because that friend was the only person I knew on that entire social network. Facebook, is Facebook a natural monopoly?
What we've traditionally thought of as natural monopolies are things like power and things like that, that basically they increase in size, and increase in size, you can't really compete against them. This doesn't really seem to be like that. There's different characteristics. They're not like the traditional, the telephone company was mm-hmm. considered this for a while, too, because you could just keep adding people, and as you added and extended the network, then no one else could do it, could have that network, and you had a natural monopoly. Facebook is actually, and these what are called two-sided platforms, are they have a different set of problems about keeping people on the network and keeping. Basically, their problem is to have they provide a way for advertisers and users of the platform to interact with one another, really. So they have to keep people coming to the platform. And so the idea is that, well, they've got this tremendous advantage and it's not going to go away. But we don't know that at all. This is a very early period in this. We've already seen, and people are fond of going back to 2006 or so, and there were magazine covers that said, is it time to regulate MySpace? Mm-hmm. Or these other companies that we no longer remember, or the browser wars were over because, well, I can't even remember the name of the browser that won at this point, right? So it could be that things have changed, but it could also be, I mean, you hear a lot now in the last 6 months or so that young people are forsaking Facebook. And that's a very bad sign, of course, for the longer term period that Facebook's. So I would say at this point, we don't know that Facebook is so dominant. We also don't know that they're engaging in behavior that is harmful to consumers. So it seems the case is not fully made, and it's mostly a case about politics and about the worry about political power, I think. And frankly, I would say also, I think a lot of the unhappiness of with Facebook is that they've been made a scapegoat, because a lot of people, of course, were upset about 2016, mm-hmm. about the changes in our politics, and many people think when something like that happens, they look around to find someone that's to blame. And Facebook, there were a lot of ads for Donald Trump on Facebook. They didn't do anything to help him, per se. They didn't take sides. but I think they got blamed for it. And a lot of what you see now is that.
I'd like to get to the politics sector of this discussion in a moment, but okay. I'd like to also ask about what is possible in regulating something like Facebook, where it's got 2.5 billion members around the world and 162 countries possibly regulating it.
That's right. I mean, that's so it's in many countries. Probably only about 20%, maybe roughly speaking, are in either the United States or Europe. In many countries outside of those, the advanced developed countries, Facebook is what people's experience of the internet is. So, you know, the United States regulations or regulations of the European Union don't extend beyond their borders. They don't. Now, it could be that Facebook and others will try to, that the European Union or Facebook will decide to adopt these, whatever the easiest thing to do, and apply it universally. But I don't think that necessarily will happen. The other question you raised, I think, is an important one, too, about, in terms of antitrust, breaking up these. Can you do that? And keeping in mind also that the sort of technology of these apps and the services is being unified in many ways. I'm not sure exactly what, in a very short time, within a year or two, and these breakups, by the way, don't antitrust actions never last, never happen in a year or two. They can be, because of the litigation and one thing or another, they can go on for decades, actually.
It wasn't the IBM antitrust something like 30 years in
yes.
the making?
And by the end of it, it was concluded that, you know, it was not clear that it was at all, that it was a good thing for the country. The Microsoft antitrust suit, which itself was sort of, it was settled, I believe, it was, it's often thought to have been one of the problems that was created for Microsoft that kept them out of the Facebook and the social media. Mm-hmm. So you have these side effects as well. So all of that, you know, I think the other thing that I think conservatives have traditionally been concerned about is the effect of international law. And so now you hear you're talking about 2 billion people worldwide. We now are starting to hear, well, Facebook should be applying international law. It should be a kind of international sovereign that's applying international law to all these countries. And I think for conservatives, that's always going to be a place where we sort of, nationalist or not, you sort of pull back and say, wait a minute, I'm not sure that's what we want to go down there.
Yeah, the UN Human Rights Charter has never really been enforced when it comes to free speech and freedom of the press.
Right.
On the political side, there's been a lot of criticism for Facebook and other social media banning certain figures because of their views. I had a friend today on Facebook. He posted an announcement about a lecture in Charlottesville about the threat to the Jewish community by the Unite the Right rally back in 2017. Mm-hmm. And Facebook briefly took it down because it contained a picture from that rally of Nazis marching in Charlottesville. This is a liberal response to far right that is being censored by Facebook because it includes a reference to the alt-right.
Well, of course, you know, the first question is anyone doing anything intentionally, or are they making errors that are caused by originally the fact that in the United States alone, again, you have 200 million people, which are only 10% of the whole Facebook crowd, really. And so the first question is it intentional or not? It sounds like, to me, in a case like that, one of the problems is they rely on, I mean, you've got all this stuff coming all the time, and you want some of it not there. Some of it is you don't want on your platform. And frankly, the users don't want it on there. And so you're trying to ferret that out as quickly as possible. I mean, an extreme case is the Christchurch shooting, right?
Right.
So you that could happen at any time. You're going to be held responsible for it in some way.
especially if you're in New Zealand now,
right,
which
right,
is reducing exactly. its protections of free speech.
So you have to get out in front of these things, but if you get out in front of them, you're going to be taking fewer chances. So is that picture from the Charlottesville events, is that a sign of some kind of extremist view, or is it what? And so it's easy to make an error in that. And then, of course, people... The other thing is we live the Facebook's, in some ways Facebook's biggest problem, I think, is we live in an era of pervasive distrust where people think that, I mean, your friend might think that, well, they're trying to push back against a liberal point of view on these events or something like that, or they're being responsive to the right wing. But then, of course, the right wing is when other things happen. You know, one of the important things to remember here is we don't really know the things that are being taken down off Facebook or for Google or Twitter. We don't know how they are distributed. We don't know if people often talk about, I hear mostly, of course, conservative media, and they many people believe it's mostly conservatives. But I've also, from time to time, I go over and read the other side. And I find that they also are, they have their cases where they think they've been taken down for political reasons. They have other concerns about all this too, but I'm not sure that we even know that they're just not taking down extremists from both sides and making lots of mistakes as you go along, because these companies are fabulously successful. They are, you know, some of the best, smartest technologists in the world work for these companies. And that leads us to think, you know, someone once said that at a certain level, technology that really works is just like magic. And that's true of these companies, of the Google search, or you think about the connections you get through Facebook. It's magic in a way. So we expect that everything's like that. But the problem of trying to... And their concerns about extremism on the platform is not something that has been, they're working on it, but it may never be that they don't make lots of mistakes in trying to curtail it.
And these are people who have brilliant mathematical minds who can write an algorithm, but probably couldn't pass a college humanities course.
I think that's fair, although it's also true that many people, they have a wide variety. Mostly, I think, in a sense, they are like Washington, where, you know, lots of lawyers. So there's engineers and lawyers, is my experience of the two companies. Some people from a different background, but you can see when you're trying to have regulations, you're having interactions with government, lawyers usually show up.
We're running out of time. I just have one last question, and maybe you can comment on this. When we're talking about removing extremist materials or improper materials, I think I read that when the Russians were interfering in the 2016 election, they placed a lot of ads on Facebook or memes and such. But the best that analysts could say is that X million numbers of people could have seen those things, but we don't know whether anybody actually looked at them, do we?
Well, they could have. What we don't know, and we remember, we don't know exactly. I think the sum is well over $100,000 of ads. They bought those ads. And they, yes, they were there, but we don't know what effect they had. And the general opinion of experts on voting behavior is that they probably, within this vast Facebook world where there's just, you know, hundreds of thousands of, I mean, Donald Trump spent $200 million on Facebook alone. And I don't think, I think he finished second to Hillary in that. So you think about 100,000, 200 million, it was such a small percentage of all the messages. And most of these things, even at the 200 million level, the spending is meant not to change minds, because people don't change their minds. It's meant to get people mobilized and motivated to go out and vote. The Russian experience here, I think, had very little effect. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't reasonable concerns that the Russians could have a unified effort to try to interfere in the elections. Of course, that's something that you expect the government to reply to, right? Because it's a sovereign, it's a sort of a... But there is one other fact we have to consider here, which is in the United States free speech tradition, you can regulate ads, you can spending on ads, but you can't really regulate messages coming from foreign nationals. There's this the American ideal that we're sort of forgetting here in all of this is the idea that the common person, the voter, is able and willing to hear this stuff, to figure it out and figure out their own interest, their own values, and proceed accordingly. Now, if we don't believe that, well, then, yeah, we ought to have the government coming in and, you know, protecting people from these ideas. But, you know, we allow in the United States a Russian television channel to operate freely. Mm-hmm. It's a great testament to, I think, our confidence in our traditions.
Well, John Samples, thank you for your time today and your insights. I really appreciate you joining us on The Score from Bering Drift again. Thank you.
Did you miss the previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at beringdrift.com.
It's graduation time all around the country. High school and college students and their families are celebrating the successful completion of their studies and looking forward to life in the real world. At the University of Virginia, graduation ceremonies are called final exercises. Coy Barefoot, executive director of the Charlottesville Museum for History and Culture, looks back at the earliest UVA graduation traditions. We spoke on Thursday morning at the museum.
We're here at the Charlottesville Museum of History and Culture, which many people may know as the Charlottesville Albemarle Historical Society over the years, downtown Charlottesville. I'm with the executive director, Coy Barefoot, and we're heading into graduation weekend here in Charlottesville. People will know it from the traffic, one of the idiosyncrasies of the University of Virginia is calling its commencement ceremony final exercises. Do you know where that term came from?
I don't, and I should. It's definitely something worth looking into. I do know that in the 19th century, what we now recognize as final exercises or graduation ceremonies was called public day. And it makes sense, right? It was the day when the university would open itself to the public, and they would choose some of the best students to present their work. So you can think of it as sort of a very public scholarly lecture that this student, say from mathematics, would deliver a prize paper, or somebody, a political science student, would speak about an essay that he wrote about government. So. And the public, and who were obviously mostly family members, would come to Charlottesville and sit in for these public day ceremonies that were, of course, recognizing the fact that these students had finished their coursework, had satisfied the requirements for degrees, which I should say as a tangent, that was an evolving process. It didn't, UVA, of course, wasn't born full flower the year it was created, which the first day of classes was Monday morning, March 7th, 1825. It took years for them to sort of figure out which degrees do we offer, what are the requirements, and they continue even into the 21st century to fine-tune that and to figure out exactly what courses match for what degrees. And there's actually a big effort right now at UVA to sort of recreate the first year experience, so that they create more common classes and get students on the same page rather than seeing them so quickly go off into the pursuits of separate majors and these degrees. But I guess the takeaway here, what I'm trying to say is, this is an evolving process. Education has always been something that is constantly being created, reinvented, rebranded, and we figure it out as we go along.
Every long-standing tradition was once a brand new idea.
Yes.
You posted on Facebook a few days ago a historical note that at the final exercises in 1940, Franklin Roosevelt, who was then president, spoke at the University of Virginia. Was he the most prominent speaker at a graduation ceremony at UVA, or were there other presidents who may have made the trip?
Off the top of my head, I can't say who spoke when, but I do know that that moment that FDR spoke was arguably the most important graduation moment that UVA had seen, because, and folks can look this up online, his speech is online, and there's articles about this, but he came down on the train. They picked him up at the Union Station, the Union Depot on West Main Street, and in the car he was looking over his notes as he, you know, driving to the graduation, and he was writing in some comments into the speech in pencil, and that copies of that speech are at special collections at UVA. It's remarkable when you see it, because there was a downpour that day, so the graduation ceremonies were held in the amphitheater, which was built in 1916, and they were normally held there, but because it was raining, they had to move it into Mem Gym, which opened in 1924. So he spoke on the basketball court in Memorial Gymnasium, and he said in that speech, it was the first time that he had said so emphatically and directly, without any, with no hedging at all, that America was going to have to get involved in the wars in Europe, what we now call the Second World War. And that morning, that May morning, rainy morning in Charlottesville in 1940, there was, you know, radios were carrying it, the speech nationwide, and it was the first moment America realized, holy cow, we're going to go to war. We can't sit idle anymore. And of course, there's a long backstory to that, the neutrality agreements in the 1930s, and there were so many in America who, based on their experience of World War I, they didn't want to have anything to do with any wars in Europe ever again. They thought, hey, that's your problem. But it was that morning in Charlottesville when FDR said, we can't afford to just sit by anymore, because the very ideals that we believe in, the very ideals that America was created to embody and to protect around the world, they are being threatened in a way that we've never seen in our lifetime.
And it's around that time that the industrial buildup to World War II began, long before Pearl Harbor, including right here in Charlottesville at the X factory, which made the parachutes that were used on D-Day.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? It's so amazing how when you look at history and you start to connect the dots, there'll be a dot that falls in your front yard or your backyard, connected to some major significant national event. And that's the most rewarding thing, I think, personally for me in doing this work with the story of Central Virginia, is our story here is America's story. Our local history. It's the benefit of not being in, say, Kansas or Portland. Mm-hmm. Our local story here in Central Virginia is America's story. All the way back to the Monacan peoples, who were the native peoples here when John Smith is down at Jamestown, but even the ancestors of the Monacans. I mean, there's archaeological evidence for people in Virginia tens of thousands of years ago. And the latest evidence is that they came from Europe. They didn't come over some ice bridge from Asia. They actually were following glacial coastlines during the Ice Age, which were very, very different then, of course. And so they could get over here pretty easily from places like France. And that's the evidence for that is pretty conclusive by now, that the earliest settlers in Virginia, 20,000 years ago, say, came from Europe.
Wow, that's news to me.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, it really is fascinating.
But just one more local point. You mentioned in 1940, graduation ceremonies took place in the McIntyre Amphitheater on the grounds of UVA. So that implies to me that the whole tradition of walking the lawn is new, at least within the past 75 years or so.
Yeah, I don't. It's definitely new. It wasn't a 19th century thing. But I'm trying to remember where they were even before. Before the amphitheater there in Old Cabell Hall, which opens, what, 1902, 1904 mm-hmm. in there. And before that, they're in what was called the Public Hall, which was, it was a building that was built, if you can picture this, picture a gigantic building on the face of the rotunda mm-hmm. on University Avenue.
Okay.
Which was built in 1853, and that's where on Sunday morning, October 27th, 1895, there was an electrical fire in that annex building, the public hall, which was attached to the rotunda, which as Jefferson designed it, that's the back door, right? Uh-huh. That was the back of the rotunda, and there was nothing ever special about it, which is why when it came time to add offices and classroom space, they just attached a big building in the 1850s on the back of the rotunda, had a huge public hall in it, sat, I think, 2,000 people. It was massive.
Oh, that's bigger than Cavill Hall.
Yeah, and it was the largest public hall in the South throughout the 19th century.
Thank you for talking to us about local and national and international history. We're with Coy Barefoot at the Charlottesville Museum of History and Culture.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
Last week, the Trump administration announced that tariffs on Chinese goods purchased by American consumers and businesses will rise to 25%. Raising taxes is not something most presidents like to brag about, but Donald Trump does. I went to the Cato Institute in Washington last Monday and talked to trade policy analyst Daniel Eikenson. I asked him how these tariffs will damage the U.S. economy.
Well, they are certainly adding costs for businesses that rely on imported intermediate goods, raw materials, capital equipment. And what that does is drive up the cost of production and reduces profits. And when manufacturers have reduced profits, they invest less, they hire less, and it could trigger, you know, a recession. Meanwhile, consumers, when they go to the stores, the retail stores, are seeing higher prices, which means that their costs of living are higher. They're getting less bang for their buck. The taxes work through both channels in an adverse way. Meanwhile, there's retaliation against U.S. manufacturers and farmers, and what they're seeing is the revenues go down. So that's the other side of the profit equation. Revenues are going down, costs are going up, so it's squeezing profits even more. So it's a high-stakes game for Trump. I mean, he sees some problems in China that he wants fixed, and I share his concerns about these problems, some of them. And interestingly, I think there's broad bipartisan support for the tougher tack the United States is taking toward China. I think had Hillary Clinton been elected, she would have had an aggressive policy, but she probably would have brought a case to the World Trade Organization, sponsored by the U.S. and the EU and Japan and Korea, so that we would have more leverage to compel China to come into compliance and to do better. But the bottom line is, the president is willing to risk the economy, it seems, risk higher costs for businesses, less spending power for families, in order to get China to make some serious reforms. And those reforms are needed in the areas of forced technology transfer, do a better job of intellectual property protection, reduce the scope of state-owned enterprises in the economy. These are things that U.S. businesses have been complaining about for a long time, and many of them have been reluctant to actually furnish the evidence to previous administrations because they were concerned that maybe Beijing would face retribution from Beijing. So I think that's one of the reasons that Trump went it alone, to just kind of get them off the hook. And maybe also because the solution he's trying to negotiate with the Chinese might be advantageous to U.S. businesses, whereas if he had gone with the Europeans and the Japanese and the Koreans, there would have been sort of a multilateral solution. So I still think that's the better approach, rule of law approach, but I think maybe Trump thinks he can score some benefits for U.S. exporters by having a mano-a-mano negotiation.
Yeah, President Trump seems to have an aversion to multilateral action or agreements of any sort. He pulled out of the TPP, for instance, mm-hmm. which would have gone a long way to solving this problem with China, since China was not part of that agreement.
That's right. So I mean, TPP was sort of characterized as a the economic component of the pivot to Asia, and as working to sort of contain China. And I didn't think that was a proper characterization of it, and I think it was inflammatory. And in fact, our friends in New Zealand and Singapore and Malaysia and other countries would say things like, "Don't make us choose between the United States and China. This, this is not the one or the other." And but that was the way it was sold. The TPP was sold on Capitol Hill, because in the United States, whereas there was widespread embrace of the benefits of trade, when it came to China, there was much greater skepticism. So it was seen as a winning political solution to cast this as an anti-China initiative. That said, the more subtle interpretation, which you were getting at, is that this is by having an agreement that included many of China's peripheral trading partners, located right next door, in the agreement, China would see investment going outside of its orbit and going to these countries that are where there's a U.S.-Japan-centric sort of arrangement. And so China, I think, would have felt compelled to join the TPP, and maybe it would have been called the Free Trade Area of the Asia-Pacific by then. But I think that would have compelled China to raise its standards to adhere to the rule of law better than it has so far. So, yes, the president has an aversion to international organizations, international agreements. I think that there's this view among economic nationalists in the United States that the U.S. Has its sovereignty sort of usurped when it's in part of these international coalitions, that the U.S. ends up contributing disproportionately more resources, that there is an anti-American bent at the World Trade Organization, which is absolutely not true. In fact, the president complains that we always lose our cases at the WTO.
We win 95% of our cases there.
Yeah, about 90%. Every complainant, the numbers are about the same. When you're a complainant, you're pretty sure you're going to win, and you win 90% of the time. When you're a defendant, you lose about 90% of the time. And so the system works pretty well, but I think this administration wants sort of the flexibility to be able to act unilaterally and in what it perceives to be in our best interests. The World Trade Organization was the evolved out of the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which was created in 1947 in the wake of World War II, to foster good economic relations among neighbors and to keep the peace. And I think at the time, the United States, presidents going back really to before Truman, to FDR, through Obama, saw trade as this sort of salve and this way to build strong relations. And I think there's a change now that's afoot. It might be broader than just among Trump and his cabinet, but that some of these international institutions are not in our interest anymore to be a part of it. Maybe we need to lead unilaterally, but we don't know what that world is going to look like. And so I think that creates a lot of concern, the uncertainty.
I think if I hear what you're saying correctly, our trading partners in the Pacific region look on China and the United States not as either or, but as both and.
Yes, they would certainly prefer that. So any smaller country, I think, would like to have access to the markets of the two largest economies in the world. They would like to have access to the output and the labor inputs from those economies. They just simply don't want to have to choose, and we shouldn't be compelling governments to choose. Look, the reality is China is different in 2019 than it was in 2001. In 2001, when it joined the WTO, it had just engaged in about 13 years of reforms and liberalization. It was trying to make amends for some really bad economic policies that ended up, keeping its economy tiny and killing tens of millions of Chinese people. So they joined, and we rationalized it, or we accepted it as as something that was going to benefit the world, that bringing China into the global economy would be good for China, would be good for everybody else. In 2019, they're a rich country, second largest economy in the world. They have a president who is now president for life, who is more committed to Leninist doctrine than anybody going back to Mao. He is surveilling his population. He's exporting surveillance technology to other countries so that they can surveil their populations. He's got concentration camps for Muslims. So there is a reason, a legitimate reason to be concerned, I think, about China. But is it a legitimate response to put your own economy on the line by yourselves to compel China to change? I think if we joined hands with the community of nations to confront China, we would have a greater likelihood of success.
What do you know about the damages faced by American farmers in the wake of this trade war?
So U.S. soy farmers have been hit especially hard, not only by the trade war, but by weather conditions. It's just a double whammy. They've been the main target of retaliation, and these are among the most patriotic Americans. And so some of them, many of them, I hear it from, on radio and TV, and I read it in the paper, express the sentiment that, there's a bigger purpose here. We are being hurt in the short run, but, we need to do something about reining in China's practices. And it's almost akin to, Eisenhower and the generals in World War II knowing that there were going to be a lot of casualties on the beaches of Normandy. And people were, willing to sacrifice for this bigger cause. The question is it really that big a cause? And how long will people be able to hang on? The president is trying to subsidize the farmers. He's already made available, last year he made available $12 billion to farmers, and he's trying to steer more in their direction so that they can hang on. One of the problems that the president faces, and one of the reasons that he has to stay tough and that it's going to be hard to close this negotiation with China, is if he doesn't get just about everything he said he's going to get, the Democrats are going to slam him on it, I think. I think he's going to be outflanked. The Democrats want to outflank him on China and contest him for Rust Belt workers who went for Trump in 2016 who may be back in play. Some of them have been hurt by Trump's tariffs. Some of the farmers, we saw in the midterm election, some of the districts in Illinois and Iowa where soy is grown that have always been Republican strongholds became much less Republican or flipped. And so he's got to be thinking about delivering something for those folks. And if he doesn't, I think the Democrats are going to try to figure out a way to slam him on it.
If I interpret him correctly, the president is looking to return the United States to the kind of manufacturing society it was in the mid-20th century. But the U.S. manufacturing sector is bigger today than it has ever been before. Is that correct?
That is correct. So the U.S. manufacturing sector, as a share of the U.S. economy, peaked in 1953. It was, I think, 28.1% of the economy. And since then, it's been going down as a share, but in absolute terms, it's been going up. It's just that the services part of our economy has been growing faster. So forget exactly the numbers. So in 1953, when U.S. manufacturing was at its peak, there was 100 and... I think it produced $135 billion of value added. And I can't remember the numbers. I've written this several times. Last year, the manufacturing value added was about $2 trillion mm-hmm. with far fewer workers. I mean, now we've got like 13 million workers in manufacturing. At that time, we had about 18 million.
In a much smaller population.
But in other words, when manufacturing was absolutely essential to the U.S. economy, as it was a big chunk of the economy, we produced so much less than we do today when it's just a fraction of its value to the economy. Manufacturing jobs peaked in 1979 at 19.4 million, and it's been pretty much in a downward trajectory since. The past few years, there's been some increases. But it's all because of technology. I mean, we produce a lot more with fewer inputs because we've endowed ourselves with better capital. And so this gets to the broader question of, should we be indicting trade? Should we be looking at trade differently than we look at other phenomena in our economy, like technology, mm-hmm. robotics, driverless technology? I mean, we've got something like 1 million truck drivers in America whose jobs could be imperiled in a few years from driverless trucks. So when we focus our concerns on dislocation caused by international trade, outsourcing imports, and we don't think about these other things, we're doing two things. One, we're demonizing trade, so we're going to get less of it, and we're going to penalize it more, which is going to raise the cost for everybody. And secondly, we're overlooking a solution. If we're going to have a social safety net, and I think that we should, it should be one that catches people who lose their jobs from technological change as well, for any reason. But it also has to be one that springboards people back into the economy, fast, so that they're not too comfortable living outside of the economy.
Well, thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
You bet. You bet.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. Feel free to join the conversation by leaving comments on The Score at BeringDrift.com. We'll be watching for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at RickSincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.